Southwest Madagascar. Some really cool, upbeat, kind of psych dance, guitar solo music, really cool stuff. I always butcher this name, but I love the music. Antonio Infantino ed E. Tarantolati de Tricarico. Some really cool kind of pagan folk music from Italy, 1978. Folly del Divino Spirito Santo is the name of the album. Yeah, thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh. Have a great night. Take care of yourselves.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is Forbes Avenue, WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Aubriana Bench, and I'm here with Ben Carter.
Hi there.
Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, what you do?
I'm the scene shop supervisor in the School of Drama here at Carnegie Mellon, and also an instructor teaching a few classes.
How long have you been here for?
Just finishing my 35th year.
During my brief research into what you do, I saw that you are a CMU alum.
Yes, it's true. I graduated in 1984.
Oh, what made you decide to come back here?
They called me. I was originally a drama student for a year, and then I switched to sculpture and graduated from there. And went out and worked for 3 years, and then they called me out of the blue and asked me to come back and teach. So the rest is history.
I heard through the grapevine, because we know each other, that right. You have experience working on feature films.
Yes, it's true. Yes, that is correct.
I saw that it was like construction, special props, and consulting. How did you get introduced to doing this?
One of the things that the sculpture world teaches you is that there's no jobs in the sculpture world if you get a sculpture degree. But what it does teach you also is that there are businesses out there that use all the same technologies and techniques and materials and strange problem-solving strategies that dovetail very nicely into that. And the one business that I still had kind of a background interest in was entertainment, motion pictures, television, etc. And when I started here at CMU, that is what this department is. And then because of my woodworking experience, I immediately got a job on a movie building specialty stunt props for Night of the Living Dead, which was being shot here in Pittsburgh. And we had to do a custom railing for somebody to fall through. And that was a perfect segue from one discipline into the other. And from there, it was just, oh, you can do that? Oh, you've done that? Next thing you know, here we are many, many years later. So
that's really cool. How many films have you done since then?
20-some, but I stopped doing it about 10 years ago because it was too many other things going on. But it will consume your life completely. And I was doing it as a side job on top of my full-time job. And it's easily a full-time job on its own, especially if there's more than one movie in town, then you just don't sleep. So, yeah, I could go back over and count how many it is if somebody really needed an actual number, but it's over 20, so.
What was it like going from that experience and then coming back to CMU? Like, how are maybe like the people different in that field? And then
we are that field, the drama department. We train those people to go out into that business. So It's the same bunch of crazies that you deal with, and the same ridiculous deadlines, and the same budgets, the same lack of sleep, the same intensity of work, attention to detail. It's very, very, very rewarding and very, very fast-paced. And our department is very, very much the same way too. So our students are really, really pushed really, really hard to get the best out of them. And that is what the entertainment industry is very, very much based on, that mentality too. So they really expect people to just show up and give 100% or more all the time, every day until the show's over. And then everybody goes in their own way, and then somebody else comes in and starts it all. And that's just to get things done that fast and that accurately, again and again and again. There's very, very little room for taking a breath or making any mistakes. So that's what we train.
Yeah, so it's just different place, but same exact type of people, same vibe.
It's very, very similar. And the big, big difference is the movie business pays so much better.
What films did you do? Like, maybe what was one of your favorites that you worked on?
We've done bits and pieces on a lot of them, but one of the ones that we had the most work on was a film called Striking Distance. It was a Bruce Willis film that they shot here a while back in 1992. And that was just an entire summer of not all day every day, because I was working here doing pre-college as well. We were doing special props on that movie, so they just needed various things like a huge pile of artificial rock cocaine. They needed a rubber shotgun that they could smack somebody with. It was shot on the rivers, so they had a police boat that they needed to have completely outfitted with all the electronics and lights and siren and all that stuff, so we did all that. They had a van that they just handed us, a blank van, and said, hey, turn this into a broadcast media van. So we had to put all the antennas and all the telescoping satellite dishes, which we all had to build everything from scratch too. So it's a really wide variety of stuff that they ask you to do, and you never know what you're going to get, because that's the nature of the business too, is they have something in their mind, and they show you a napkin sketch and they say, can you build this? And then they say, how much? And you kind of come up with an idea how you're going to build it, what it's going to be made out of. And very oftentimes you haven't used these materials before, and you just have to sort of trust yourself and just throw yourself into it. And somehow or other, we were never late. They always loved it. I have no idea, looking back on it, how that ever happened, but it's so fun, and it's so stressful, and it's really neat compared to the theater world, because you can always go back years later. To this day, I can go on YouTube, pull up any one of those movies in any one of those segments, and scroll through the segments of those movies and show anybody any of the props that we built, if it made it to the movie, because a lot of things you make, they end up on the cutting room floor. They get edited out for whatever time reasons or whatever. But anything that did make the movie, you can always go on there and say, scroll through and say, yeah, there it is. There is Ben Affleck stabbing Matt Damon with this knife that you made. So it's really fun. And there's a history. It's documented. So that's what I like about it, compared to doing theater work where everything goes in the dumpster.
Yeah.
So.
You keep saying we. Is the we like you and other people at CMU, or did you work with a group?
When we were doing movie stuff, I was an independent contractor always.
Okay.
Pretty much. So I didn't join a union or anything. We just had our own shop at home. My wife and I were basically the company. She was a painter more. She'd do the custom painting work on things, and I would do all the structural, actual construction of everything. And then periodically, we did a movie called The Piano Lesson, an August Wilson movie for Hallmark Channel. And they needed a carved piano, and it all had to be carved from scratch. They gave us drawings that they wanted it to match. And there was just too many hours involved carving it. So at that time, I was still connected with the wood shop where I used to work. And we did a lot of hand carving at the wood shop. So I called one of my friends there and hired him to come in and help me. He was a really good master wood carver. So we spent a lot of time together just carving all these wooden panels all over the piano. So depending on who you're working what your project is, who you're working with or who you're working for, you can tap back into your former or present lives and get different people with different skill sets to jump in on the project and then jump back out again. And if they're really busy and they don't want to do it, that could be a real problem, but usually you just show them a stack of money and they're like, oh yeah, I have time for that.
Olav, your son, told me that you have a piece of glass from The Silence of the Lambs.
It's a piece of Lexan, yeah.
Yeah. How did you do a lot of props for that?
No, I didn't even work on that. We were on another project at that time when that was being filmed here. But it was a piece of Hannibal Lecter's cage, the Lexan panels that somebody had made for the movie, because they don't generally go to the store and buy those things. Most of what you see is made, custom made for stuff like that. And when they tear down sets, a lot of it gets thrown away. A lot of it, if it's very interesting little pieces, people tend to hang on to as mementos of their experience, or if they think that maybe they can use it for something. Well, one of my good friends from back in the day, Lou Taylor, who was the construction coordinator on that movie, he took that with him, one of those panels. Who knows what happened to the other ones, but he took it with him and then brought it onto another movie that I was working called, a Stephen King movie called Dark Half, that was shot here. And they needed that panel as a backing panel in a shower door so they could slam against the shower door without breaking the shower door. And when that movie wrapped, he just happened to have it, said, I know how to do that. I have just a thing for that. We can shine light through it and you can't see it. And then when that movie wrapped, he didn't want that thing anymore. I was helping clean up. And I said, can I have it? And they said, get it out of here. So now that's in my basement. So you do tend to keep things that are kind of unusual and neat. I was going to make a dining table out of it, but I never did.
Okay. I wanted to know the story behind that because I'm just a big horror movie nerd. But I'm talking to Ben Carter, instructor at the theater department in CMU. And I just wanted to keep talking to you about what you were doing in the film scene here. You said that you would do stuff for props like in your backyard. Is that where you would mostly do stuff?
Or in our shop, in our home. We had at that point, when we first started doing it, we had bought a building down on the north side, an old salad dressing factory, and turned it into our house. So we had an apartment. We had a shop, we had a garage, and of course a music room, because you know you have to have a jammer. So, and the shop was a pretty good sized shop. So there was a metalworking area, a casting and mold making area, a carpentry area, a drafting area, and there was just because you have to use so many different types of technologies and tools and materials. Coming back to the sculpture world, it's all those things all just came back together into an actual job that actually works, that actually makes money, that's objective. The sculpture world and art world is completely subjective, and the whole value of everything you do is completely up to the viewer or the art gallery owner, whatever, which is really, really kind of unknown, and you can't count on paying your bills that way. So yeah, all those same technologies and all those same materials and techniques and everything, they all translate directly into entertainment, where you need all that same stuff, and there it is, and it worked. And you can say for sure it's more like an engineering job, where you can say yes, that actually fulfilled the project goals successfully, and here is your paycheck moving on, instead of being just sort of surreal and weird, which is the art world. So
I just want to wrap up what we've talked about. Based on when you were involved in it, how was the Pittsburgh film scene in general? I know we've talked a lot about it. I know we've said it's kind of not very different from CMU because it's all the same people, but based on when you were there, how was it?
At CMU, you mean?
In the Pittsburgh film scene.
Well, it's been going on for 100 years, so and it kind of comes and goes depending on a lot of different things, tax incentives and things like that, and other cities are always trying to get the money and get the business to come here. And we'll go a year sometimes without something, and then sometimes we'll have three or four films being shot here at once. And right now, Mayor of Kingstown is shooting again We just drove by the prison today, and there's a row of Haddad's trucks, which is, you know, the local people that support all the logistics of that. So they're still filming away again. I haven't committed my life to the industry, so I'm really sort of superficially involved in it. Like, I would just jump in and jump out as needed. I never, ever once had to make a phone call and say, hey, does anybody have any work? It's more like I'd be doing something already and somebody would call. Or once people know what you do, they don't want to do job interviews and research. They want to call someone and say, hey, I'm in town. I don't know anybody who does this. And it's a relatively small community in this town, about in the movie industry, so everybody knows everybody. So if somebody says, who does special props, there's only a couple people that do it. Now, I don't do it anymore. Unfortunately, there's a couple other people around that took over that and do it on a really large scale. And we still stay in touch and can compare ideas and things now and then, too. But you can't really say it's a thriving industry. There was a point where it was a few years ago, probably 20 years ago, a lot of local carpenters quit their construction jobs and just joined the union and became full-time movie carpenters. And then that's not a good way to do it. You make lots of money for, you know, 6 or 9 months or something like that, and then that movie wraps and they're gone, and then you don't know if another one's coming. Yet you've quit your jobs and you don't know what you're going to do, and then maybe you take on another construction job and another movie comes in. So sometimes they overlap too. So like, you're really heavy deep into one and another one starts and they want you to come work for them, yet you're already signed on to this one, and they don't really care if one is already going. So the industry is just like that. And in Pittsburgh, where we're not really historically like LA or something, which is like known for being a movie town, outside of Pittsburgh, it's not as reliable as a source of income, for instance, if you want to dedicate your life and family and your bills to it. So doing it as a subcontractor occasionally was really, really fun and really nice. So it was. Yeah. It's too much now between, you know, life and family and puppies and Airbnbs and things like that. No more.
Yeah. I'm talking with Ben Carter, a theater instructor at CMU. And I want to talk a bit about what you do at CMU now.
Yeah.
Because if you can't hear, we're in the scene shop. Lots of background noise, people talking, movement around. And you have machines here that you can kind of do stuff with. And
Yeah, the nature of a scene shop is kind of interesting, because what we do in the theater is we basically make a microcosm of the real world on stage. So it's all the same materials. It's all, you know, plumbing and electrical and carpentry and metalworking and welding and machining and all the same things that you would have in the real world, except on a much smaller scale. So we have to do bits and pieces of all the things. So if you had to hire a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter to do your house, we have to do all those things in little bits and pieces, but they all have to be just as functional as they would be in your real house, but on stage. And then to support that, our shop has to have the same capabilities as if you were building an entire house, basically, all the same stuff. So we have tons of carpentry equipment. This whole side of the shop is basically for woodworking. That whole side of the shop is basically for metalworking. So we build more and more and more sets out of metals, mostly steel these days. And that all depends on the designer. We never know. So since we do things on a large scale, we like to buy machinery that's sort of scaled up for that we get from the industrial world, the manufacturing sector, basically. So our machines aren't what you would see like in a high school theater shop. They're pulled right from real industrial shops that are designed to run 24 hours a day.
Richard is pointing to the hamburger, like, right above your
head.
Okay,
so the hamburger, it's a cheeseburger, actually.
They're
one of the classes they do here in the advanced paint class is they have to do a sculpture out of something three-dimensionally. And sometimes they're very large. You'll see, like, there's a mastodon head over there and a dinosaur head up there. They make them as part of their graduate thesis projects, and they're usually big, and they're very fancy, and they're super well made. And they graduate, and they can't take that on a plane. So sometimes they just dumpster them, and sometimes it's just like, no, we really want that. So up, it gets hung on the wall or hung on the ceiling, and then that hamburger and that car, that was actually a prop from a show. But they loved it so much they couldn't bear to scrap it, so they hung it on the wall. We only have so much wall space, you know, so. But, like, the cheeseburger was just so funny, you know, that we couldn't do anything with it. And at least twice, people have come to us and said, we heard you have a giant cheeseburger. And one was a hamburger shop that wanted to borrow it for their opening of their hamburger shop so that they could have it. And somebody else needed it for some show somewhere. So we bring in our lift and we bring it up and take down the cheeseburger. And it goes in a crate and goes away. But that's the kind of thing. If it's that cool and it's that easy to hang on to, it's just fun. And it's just, the whole industry is kind of, it's so silly. You know, the whole theater industry and everything, it's all fake and it's all silly. And sometimes you get to hang on to really cool stuff like that.
Yeah. When my brother and I came in here to make a sign for the film we were working on last summer, you graciously let us use your CNC machine.
Yeah.
So do you want to maybe take me on a walk throughout the shop and maybe show us what your favorite machine is.
Well, like I said, this is the woodworking area. We have the usual table saw and radial arm saw. So we have things for processing sheet goods like plywood and lumber. That's this whole side of the room. And that whole side of the room is the paint shop. So we build everything down here and then we send it all down there. One way or another. Sometimes it's too big and sometimes we actually have to build it and then just ship it directly into the theater. Like this is all for Titanic. So
this staircase is going to be in the set for Titanic?
Yeah. And you see it's all bolted to the floor now so that they can run up and down on it and whatever. But you notice that it also really, really quickly comes apart so that we can take it in pieces. Sometimes we'll build a huge, huge set in here that can't come apart and we'll put it all on wheels. And then we open that giant door. There's another giant door that goes onto the stage. And then we get 20 people just to roll the entire thing in there in one piece. So sometimes we do little tiny things. Sometimes we do things that are 50 feet long. That's the nature of this business. So we would rather not have this monstrosity in the middle of the shop. But that's what we do.
Yeah.
It has to go somewhere. It doesn't fit anywhere else. So over here, so that's, like I said, that's all plywood. Soft materials relatively that we cut over. And this is all for metal. This is a milling machine that we're currently set up. We have a computer controlled aspect of this machine that we can put a piece of material in there and then do some programming, and it will do a bunch of processing to the piece of metal for you according to the program that you did. So right now we have it set up to do that as we're making some brackets for the lighting department to hang this lighting instruments on the front of the stage that don't exist. So they come to us and say, hey, we have this weird application for this stuff, and these things that we need, nobody makes. And that's kind of the nature of this business, is that people are always saying, we want you to fill this weird gap that nobody has ever filled before, and this is the materials and this is the needs you have to do for it. So can anybody make that?
Yeah.
So this is one of my classes, advanced fabrication class, they come to us and say, hey, can your class make these weird things? I say, well, absolutely. So whatever the curriculum is for the day gets changed, and then we go off to make these weird things for them.
Yeah.
So we also use this for other things in class too. We just happen to be using it right now for that. I can show you an example of that over here.
Sure.
So there's also, under there, there's a metal lathe. If we have to make custom round things, we do a lot of automation, a lot of computer-generated automation and winches and things that move things around the stage. And we do a lot of adaptation of mechanical components. Like they'll bring us a sprocket or a gear or a shaft or a bearing, and they'll say, to make this work, we have to make this go with that, but that hole's too big or this is too small. And if we have to make a hole larger or a shaft smaller, we'll put it on the lathe and turn it down until it fits what... make all the components go together. So not your usual scene shop stuff, but we're not your usual scene shop too.
Yeah.
At the highest level of this industry, if you go out and look at the professional shops who are doing, you know, the Broadway things and the touring rock and roll shows and things like that, they all have shops that are 10 times this size and way more sophisticated than this, as if it's actually a real manufacturing facility where they're making products. And they're making a product, it's just that that product is usually used once or twice, or maybe on a tour or something like that, and then it's just shelved. But we have to do it with the same level of intensity and accuracy and tolerance and budgets and speed and all that. So it's a weird hybrid of worlds that collide. So we have metal cutting tools and metal drilling tools, another little miniature version of that milling machine, band saws for cutting metal, belt sanders for grinding metal, things like this iron worker machine, which does a whole bunch of different things. The machine I showed you there that I had to set up to drill holes, this is one of those brackets. So it drills all those holes, and then we bring it over here and put it in here, and it does all these bends.
Whoa.
We have it all preset to little certain marks. You set it in there, you push the button, and it bends it up. If you want a sound bite, I'll give you an idea what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
If I want to put it in there, if I want to do a bend, this is an extra one. So. And this is, it's been changed so that that angle isn't correct right now. But I mean, that's a general, I mean, this is not a machine like so many other machines and materials that we have in the shop. Nothing has been at all, zero of this has been designed and engineered and built for the entertainment industry. It's all been taken from the manufacturing or constructions or R&D or scientific community. One of those sectors, somebody has already made the machinery that we need, and we say, well, we have to make this thing. We need a machine to do that. We have to make enough of them that it's worth spending $80,000 for that machine. And when I started here, nobody had heard of any of this stuff, because we were just building things with hammers and nails and screws and then throwing it away. And that's not how it's done today.
Yeah.
So you have to do things fast and repeatedly, and that's where things like this thing, this CNC router, come in handy, because we have to do huge square foot areas of scenery. So like you see those carts there with all those pieces of wood on them.
Yeah.
They have a notch cut all the way around the outside of them, and then some slots cut through the middle of them. If we did that by hand, it would take days and days and days of just doing it with a hand router or a saw of some sort, whatever. Well, we can take one of those sheets, fasten it down onto this thing, and it takes about 5 minutes to cut each one, and they're all absolutely perfect.
Do you keep up with what goes on in the drama department these days? Like, do you know about the
show? As I need to. There's a lot of people who, you kind of learn it, when you stick your nose into situations. There's so much going on, and there's so many people that are so overloaded with work that, if you show an interest in something, next thing you know, even if it's a passing interest, next thing you know, you've got more responsibility than you wanted. And
yeah.
Something is your fault that you just asked a little question about. So I only know what comes through the shop, and I don't care what the designs are anymore. I don't when it leaves this shop, I don't care what happens to it. Basically, I just teach people how to use the tools, what they're actually building or when they need them by and all that. That's out of my world now. So we just try to get them really prepared to go out in the real world and be really, really active, creative problem solvers, and know, most importantly, to look at a project, no matter what the scale is, and say, this is my skill set. This is what kind of tools we have at this shop. This is what our personnel can do. Can we do that? How long will it take us to do that? Do we need to job portions of this project out to other shops? And maybe it's too much at all. And then eventually, how much will it cost? How long will it take? So the whole idea of most of the students that come through our shop here they're really pushing them to be managers and business owners, project managers. So, and estimators and integrators and logistics people. Out in on a really large scale stuff. Very few people leave here after spending the money and go back, to be their high school technical director or a regional theater person. Some of them do because that's what they want to do. But once you get exposed to a lot of really, really high-end, really cool stuff here, and you meet a lot of people who have come through here who are now really huge in the industry, and they're going to come back in and say, oh, you want to go work at your high school, do you? Okay. And then they'll say, check this out, look what we did. Then they blow their minds, and they're like, yeah, actually, I want to do something really huge and really interesting.
I'm sure it's nice for you to just kind of, as you said, be in your own space. And you had your experience with the industry, but now yeah. You're just chilling here. But is there anything you want people to know that we haven't talked about?
As far as like what to, you know, parting comments or anything like that, if you go see plays or if you go see movies or if you go see television, if you have any interest in the industry at all, wonder what it, and the only reason I'm in this business is because I always wondered when I watched a movie, how did they do that? Who got to make that thing? That is so cool. And then at some point, the door opened for me that said, you can actually do that. And I looked at my tools and my skill set and I said, my gosh, that is actually something that I might be able to do. Mm-hmm. And when I tried that, it was in fact what I wanted to do. And people told me, hey, you're good at this. So it was, next thing you know, we're 35 years later.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ben Carter, CMU shop instructor.
Yep.
It's super fun being able to work with you. I know I work for DR technically, but
that's
just
right.
Coming in and being able to see you all the time, talk to you
cool.
about the dogs.
Appreciate it.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, anything I can do to help, let me know.
Yeah, all right, cool.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're fierce. You take care of business and don't hold back. Taking care of your health shouldn't be any different. You know when something's off. Don't ignore symptoms like fatigue, joint pain, and rashes. Listen to your body. It could be lupus. We're here to help you take control. Learn how at BeFiercetakeControl.org. Brought to you by the Lupus Foundation of America and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme.
That's Heather Cox Richardson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. We are at an inflection point. A chill is sweeping the country. We ignore it at our peril. The warning signs are everywhere. Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski says, "We are all afraid." Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says, "The fear is real." New York Times columnist Masha Gessen writes, "America's police state has arrived." Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025. The moderator is UBC Professor Heidi Twarick. And now, Heather Cox Richardson.
I wanted to talk today about what's happening in the United States and to address this question of what it means to be an American in 2025. I'm going to argue today that the crisis in today's United States is the logical outcome of 40 years of a Republican ideology that was based in the idea of cowboy individualism. That idea has directed American politics since 1980, at least, when President Ronald Reagan rode it to the White House. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own, outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. That ideology is rooted in the mythological image of the American cowboy who began to drive cattle from the border of Texas and Mexico north across the plains to army posts and railheads in 1866. That image sprang to prominence in the years immediately after the Civil War, and in that peculiar moment, it took on a specific anti-government meaning, a political meaning. The Civil War government in the United States set out to protect black Americans from persecution by their white neighbors in the American South. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed equal protection of the laws to formerly enslaved people. And then 2 years later, in 1870, Congress created the Department of Justice to prosecute those people who attacked black Americans because of their race. So with the federal government suddenly willing to prosecute racial discrimination, former Confederates turned their racial animosity into an economic argument. Beginning in 1871, they claimed that the government's effort to protect civil rights was tantamount to socialism, because the government officials it required to protect black Americans cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars could only come from hardworking white men in the years after the Civil War. And they were providing that money to provide benefits for undeserving, they said, black people. Southern Democrats after the war contrasted that government socialism, as they called it, with the image of the American cowboy, who in their view was a young white man who wanted nothing from the government but to be left alone. The cowboy in their view was hardworking, he was good with a gun, and he dominated the women and the racial minorities he encountered in the West. That myth countered the idea that the government should protect all Americans equally. The cowboy image actually faded in the early 20th century progressive era, which is itself an interesting story, but it sprang back to prominence in the 1950s and the 1960s as a propaganda tool to oppose the wildly popular post-World War II government. That government reflected the idea that government had a role to play in regulating business, in providing a basic social safety net, in promoting infrastructure, and in protecting civil rights. And those people who were determined to get rid of government regulation and taxation resurrected the myth of the American cowboy, and they championed this idea of cowboy individualism. They embraced the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism, because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to black Americans, people of color, and women who demanded equal rights. The Republicans nominated Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was famous for his cowboy persona and his white cowboy hat and his opposition to the post-war government. They nominated him for president. And then, of course, in 1980, Ronald Reagan put aside his British riding clothes, put on a Western cowboy hat, and rode that ideology to the White House. That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics as a way for Republican politicians to convince voters to support the destruction of federal government programs that actually benefited them. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme. They demonized non-white Americans and women in the public sphere, and they dismissed all government policies that promoted social cooperation, whether at home or abroad. And in place of the post-World War II idea of cooperation among equals, they replaced that idea with the idea that individual men should dominate society, ordering it as they thought best. Over time, white men rejected the socialization and the education that would enable them to rise to prosperity or to develop meaningful relationships. That domination to which they turned at the heart of cowboy individualism grew increasingly apparent in the United States after 1992, when the modern militia movement took off after a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, between federal marshals and a former factory worker named Randy Weaver, who had failed to show up to court for a trial on a firearms charge, convinced a number of Western men that they had to arm themselves to fight off the government. By the early 2000s in the U.S., gun ownership first became a symbol of cultural identity, and then it became a way to groom younger people into Republican political ideology. This is why we see political leaders posing with their families holding AR-15s on Christmas cards. The Trump administration has taken cowboy individualism now to an extreme, I believe, gutting the U.S. government and centering power in a dominant president, while also pulling the United States out of the web of international organizations that have stabilized the globe since World War II. The administration began its run in 2025 by firing the women and the racial and gender minorities who held positions in the government. But it is not just exercising domination over others, it is reveling in that dominance and advertising it, especially over the migrants it has sent to prison in El Salvador, showing films of them being transported in chains and displaying caged prisoners behind Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who in those photographs and in that film is wearing a $50,000 gold Rolex watch. In place of cooperation, the Trump administration's determination to exercise its dominance shows, I think, in its plan to invest $1 trillion in the military, after gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. Trump has always seen power as a zero-sum game in which for one party to win, others must lose. If, in fact, Trump succeeds in asserting his dominance over the United States of America and over the globe, the Republicans will have succeeded in replacing American democracy with a dictatorship, and they will have rebalanced global power. But you know, with me, there's always a but, right? Those who believe in that ideology of cowboy individualism have not yet established that autocracy that is their end game, in large part because that cowboy ideology is a myth. It has never reflected reality. And right now, MAGA Republicans are watching in real time as their president, Donald Trump, lumps them in with the minorities and people of color they believed were inferior to them. The government programs that Republicans are calling wasteful are not just the ones that supported racial minorities. They are the ones that supported MAGA Republicans. Cowboy individualism was always a myth. It never represented the United States of America. It didn't even represent the cowboys, one-third of whom were black or were men of color, and whose employment actually replicated the low pay and dangerous conditions of Eastern factory workers. In fact, the American West was a multicultural world in which the key to surviving and even prospering was not dominating other people, it was kinship ties and communities. Famous Western trader Kit Carson, for example, often lionized as the real hero of cowboy individualism, spoke English, Spanish, a number of indigenous languages, and was married three times, two times to an indigenous woman, and then to a Mexican woman. When Eastern settlers moved west, they depended on communities to enable them to survive disasters because, for example, every single farm would lose a barn to fire at some point, and you needed to have people for barn raising. That focus on communities in the American West gave the United States of America grassroots political movements, which were named, after all, for the prairie grasses, whose roots can go as deep as 3.5 meters. Those movements included the late 19th century Alliance Movement and the populist movements in the late 19th century that reordered American politics. Central to those movements, those grassroots movements, were the Western women who organized to fund churches and to fund schools and who drove Western politics. For example, when the Western state of Iowa added murals to its state house in 1908 to portray the modern government, the duties of defense, charities, education, and the executive, legislative, and the judiciary, it illustrated those aspects of modern American government, all except defense and legislature, it portrayed them as women. The contrast between the myth of cowboy individualism and the reality of life in the American West matters because they represent two very different versions of the American government. Iowa's depiction of the modern government as support for an inclusive society in which women took full part was part of a larger movement in the early 20th century to change the nature of American government itself. Key to that change was social worker Frances Perkins, which is why you've been hearing so much about her from me lately. As a settlement house worker, she saw firsthand what economists will tell you today, that modern industrialization could not survive without the labor and the participation of the entire community, not just male factory workers, who were actually paid lower than survival wages. Later, when she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, Perkins also saw what happened to communities without government regulation and social services. "I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere," Perkins recalled after the fire. "It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face." With her help, the New York Democratic machine remade New York state politics to address the needs of the entire community. When Perkins became Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she took that new government philosophy to the federal level, where she ushered in a dramatic change to the nature of the federal government. With the 1935 Social Security Act, Perkins did more than provide benefits for the elderly and orphans. She created a new kind of United States government. Before Perkins, the primary function of the federal government was to manage the economic relationships between labor, capital, and resources. Property rights, after all, had been the basis on which North American colonists had found the justification, the legal justification, to rebel against the British crown. And the focus on the relationships inherent in property ownership had continued to dominate the government that American lawmakers built afterward. But Perkins recognized that the end of government was not to protect property. It was to protect the communities of people who lived in the nation. She recognized that children, the elderly, women, and disabled Americans were as valuable to that community as the young male workers and the wealthy men who employed them. And she molded the government to reflect the idea that the equal value of all Americans meant that they should all have equal protection of the laws and equal access to resources, including social services like health care, education, and child care. Her vision of the U.S. government reflected reality. But Perkins' recognition of community as the heart of the nation directly challenged the power of men who could dominate a world that had been defined by economic relationships. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, opponents worked to destroy it and the new idea of government that it represented. Reaching back to the past, they claimed that such a government would destroy men's willingness to work and ruin the individualism that made America great. In the 1930s, as soon as the New Deal reorganized government around communities, established businessmen set out to resurrect that old form of government, that old economic ideology. And to bolster their support, they welcomed racists who opposed the idea of equal rights for racial and ethnic minorities to their coalition, and that unholy alliance has been well studied. But they also turned to religious traditionalists who had stood against the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial just a dozen years before the passage of the Social Security Act. Religious traditionalists, especially those in the Southern Baptist Convention, opposed the new system because it recognized equal rights for women. Women's equality, they believed, meant the end of the patriarchy that they thought mirrored God's relationship to his people, and they saw it as an affront to God. Their position that the modern government was un-American then was strengthened in 1962 when the Supreme Court decided the Engle v. Vitale decision, which struck down state-mandated prayer in public schools, and then in 1963 when Abingdon School District v. Shemp prohibited teachers from leading students in prayer or Bible readings. The Supreme Court decisions against prayer in the schools reinforced the idea that the modern government opposed family values. That religious traditionalism took political shape in 1967 when Southern Baptist leaders Paul Pressler and Paige Patterson plotted to take the Southern Baptists back to an older view of the world. They focused on the inerrancy of the Bible, that is, the Bible can't be wrong, but it was really about women's rights, their ideology. They were denying women's equality and pushing them back into a position subordinate to men. By 1972, the issue of abortion would bring this sexist religious backlash into American politics. Abortion had become a centerpiece of the post-World War II government after doctors identified abortion access as a major public health issue in the 1960s. They estimated that there were between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal U.S. abortions a year, endangering the lives of women, primarily poor women who could not afford a workaround. By 1972, 64% of Americans believed that abortion should be a question answered by a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans believed that. But in 1972, before Roe v. Wade, President Richard Nixon was up for re-election, and he and his people were terrified that he would lose the election. So his advisor Pat Buchanan urged Nixon to woo Catholic Democrats before the election by turning to the issue of abortion. Although Nixon had virtually the same platform on the issue as Democratic nominee George McGovern, Nixon and Buchanan defined McGovern as the candidate of acid, amnesty for draft dodgers, and abortion, a radical framing designed to attract traditionalists to the Republican Party. As Nixon split the U.S. in two to rally voters, his supporters used abortion to stand in for women's rights in general. Railing against women's equal rights, in her first statement on abortion in 1972, again the year before Roe versus Wade, activist Phyllis Schlafly did not talk about fetuses, but she talked about women's equality. Women's Lib, short for Women's Liberation, is a total assault on the role of the American woman as wife and mother, and on the family as the basic unit of society. Women's libbers are trying to make wives and mothers unhappy with their career, make them feel that they are second-class citizens and abject slaves. They are promoting federal daycare centers for babies instead of homes. They are promoting abortions instead of families. In 1979, the first deadline for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment enshrining women's rights in the U.S. Constitution passed with the amendment unratified, and candidate Ronald Reagan welcomed right-wing Southern Baptist leaders like Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and Jerry Falwell into his coalition. As the power of those evangelicals grew, Republican culture attacked the modern government by relegating women to the roles of wives and mothers or as sex objects. With talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh referring to women who wanted equal rights as feminazis who were destroying society, and after 1996, the Fox News Channel portrayed women's ideal submissive role quite carefully as younger women deferred to older white male hosts like Bill O'Reilly and displayed their bodies under low-cut shirts and short skirts that could be seen under the new glass desks that they used on those sets. But this attempt to undermine the modern government was running up against women's changing political voice. American women tended to vote as their husbands did until 1980, when political observers first saw a gender gap in voting. Women turn out in higher numbers to vote than men do, and at higher rates, and they vote for Democratic candidates at higher rates than men do. If you break that statistic down by race, the numbers are even starker, with black women and women of color voting in significantly higher percentages for Democratic candidates than men do. So the attempt to get rid of the modern American state began to take shape as an evangelical emphasis on gender domination in households. Wildly popular books and religious culture emphasized a woman's duty to produce a lot of children and to do as her husband or father told her. In 2014 and 2015, this impulse to remove the equality of women from American society showed in Gamergate, when men complained about their inability to find women who would date them and began to call themselves incels or involuntary celibates and began to refer to women as NPCs, non-player characters, who are there to make the story move forward for the playing characters. By the way, a term that you see Elon Musk using a lot these days. When you see NPCs, that's what he's talking about. In the 2016 campaign, Republican candidate Donald Trump faced off against Hillary Clinton, who had so specifically defended the idea of a community-based government that she wrote a book titled It Takes a Village. Trump demonstrated his dominance over Clinton by physically looming over her at a debate. He called for her to be jailed, and then he boasted of sexual assault. But that boast of sexual assault did not end his candidacy, it strengthened it, as a certain group of Republicans saw attacks on women as attacks on the government that they hated. Once in power, Trump gave the evangelicals what they wanted by stacking the Supreme Court with justices who would overturn abortion rights. In 2025, Trump returned to power by warning voters that the modern American state was literally turning boys into girls, while his vice president, J.D. Vance, urged women to embrace traditional gender roles, including staying in abusive marriages for the sake of the children. In contrast, Democratic candidates, Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, emphasized community and the role of government in protecting that community.
You're listening to Heather Cox Richardson on Cowboy Authoritarianism in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Now, Trump's MAGA Republicans control all the branches of the government. But it is not clear that they will be able to suppress the vast majority of Americans who continue to support the government that Francis Perkins ushered in 90 years ago. For one thing, Republican voters are learning that the government they thought was helping women and minorities actually helps them and kept the nation safe. But there's also a key factor at play right now that is coming to a conclusion after the long-standing Republican attacks on women. As they did in Perkins's era, women are still central to the American community, but now there is a twist. Two generations of women striving for education meant that men backed away from professions once women reached parity in those professions, and now women are dominating educational achievement in the United States, making them more prepared for a modern government than young men are. The past 40 years has also created a new demographic. Women now have educations and connections, they have skills, often they have money, and the people who are now in the boomer generation and slightly below it are the first generation of American women to have 20 to 30 years after their children leave home to invent a second career. Many of them are turning to issues they care about, including political organizing. Indeed, so nervous are MAGA Republican leaders about women's political roles that they're trying to throw women out of political power altogether. The House passed the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or the SAVE Act, which would require all American voters to prove they are citizens by presenting documentation in person when registering to vote or updating their voter registration information. But the kicker is that your official identification has to match your current name. That means that it would disfranchise as many as 69 million American women who do not have passports and whose birth certificates are not in their current married names. That SAVE Act, I think, dovetails with the extraordinary misogyny that has come to dominate the MAGA Republican Party. And I'm going to argue that it is not an accident that the current attempt in the United States to overthrow democracy presents as an attack on American women. American women created and then maintained